Fatherless Fanny, Chapter 12, A Hoax. In the meantime, Miss Stanhope and Fanny returned to town, the former full of spirits and drollery, secretly exulting in the imposition she had practiced, of which, however, she avoided giving the slightest hint to either of her companions, fearing lest they should impede the success of her plot before she had an opportunity of laying its foundation with the security she meditated, and which, once put in train, she felt certain would defy their genius to overturn. Fanny's spirits were flurried with the accident she had met with, and she was but ill able to bear the raillery with which her lively friend attacked her.
"My dear Fanny," said Amelia, "I really think it would be the safest expedient we could hit upon to send you into the country immediately."
"Then why so?" asked Colonel Ross, for Fanny was silent.
"Why, don't you perceive," rejoined Miss Stanhope, "that she can neither walk nor ride without meeting with adventures and knight-errants? Depend upon it, she will be run away with some day, and then we shall lament the temerity that exposed her to such danger."
Colonel Ross bit his lips. It was a suggestion his own anxious heart had often presented to his fancy, but he did not dare to avow it.
"Now, don't you think it very likely to happen?" continued Miss Stanhope, looking archly. "You were afraid of the Adonis she met in the morning, but I have the most reason to be afraid now, for I will wager 1,000 guineas she steals my lover from me before I am a week older."
"Your lover?" re-echoed the colonel. "For heaven's sake, Miss Stanhope, whom do you allude to?"
"To the Duke of Albemarle," replied she. "That was the invincible knight who just now spread his fostering arms to shelter this beautiful damsel."
As Miss Stanhope spoke, Fanny's cheeks were dyed with crimson, and a deep sigh escaped her. An indistinct feeling like disappointment shot through her heart. She was sorry to hear that the stranger she had thought so agreeable was a man of whom she must think no more. She tried, however, to turn the conversation by observing that she wondered the Duke had not recognized Miss Stanhope.
"I dare say," answered Amelia, laughing, "that the Duke thinks me so much improved in beauty that he does not suspect his happiness in being destined to so lovely a creature, and so his humility pointed out a fair one more on a par with his own merits. Well, never mind, my dear, I will not pull caps with you. The Duke does not please me, but I shall not say so. Let him cry off first. A few thousands per annum will be a trifling sacrifice in the cause for which Mark Antony lost the world." In this unmerciful manner did Amelia continue to roast poor Fanny until the carriage stopped at Colonel Ross's door, and for the first time since they had become acquainted, Fanny felt rejoiced to get rid of her agreeable friend, who could not command time enough to alight to tell Lady Maria Ross the wonders of the ride, a circumstance she lamented most pathetically. Colonel Ross was as glad as Fanny to see Amelia depart, for the tempest of jealousy her suggestions had raised in his bosom required the retirement of his closet to subdue and bring within the limits of his usual self-command. To his closet, therefore, he flew as soon as he entered the house, and Fanny repaired to her own chamber, where, throwing herself on her bed, she gave way to the flood of tears that had long been struggling for freedom. She had suppressed them while in Amelia's presence, because she feared she would attribute their flowing to a silly and sudden partiality imbibed by a first-sight impression, a species of romance Fanny had always condemned when conversing with Miss Stanhope on the subject of attachment. Scarcely, indeed, could she tell herself from whence the weeping propensity originated, but felt most inclined to attribute it to the influence of her wounded pride, which had shrunk from Miss Stanhope's raillery with a degree of pain very unusual to the naturally humble-minded Fanny. "Poor outcast orphan that I am," said the weeping girl. dependent on the bounty of strangers, and unblessed even with a name. My nature assimilates not with such degrading circumstances. I feel no innate symptoms of baseness. Why, then, should I be trampled upon by those whose fortunes are better, although their sentiments may be inferior to mine? Miss Stanhope is blessed with fortune, and its sure attendance. Friends, she can command admirers. It is ungenerous, therefore, in her to make my insignificance the subject of her amusement.
These reflections were the bitterest Fanny had ever made. The secret cause that made them so, I leave to my sagacious female readers to find out, not in the least doubting that they will be able to ascribe the effect to its genuine cause. And with those who are clear-sighted enough to unravel the mystery, I flatter myself poor Fanny will stand acquitted of habitual ill-humor. A little acrimony may surely be excused on so trying an occasion. In the few hours after Miss Stanhope's return home, she received a note from the Duke of Albemarle, announcing his arrival and entreating permission to pay his compliments in person to the lady who held his future happiness at her disposal. Amelia answered the note, and fixed the following morning for receiving the visit of the impatient lover. The Duke thought this interval an age, but he was forced to submit. And the mischievous Amelia enjoyed the double pleasure of reflecting on his present suspense and approaching disappointment. When the appointed hour arrived, the Duke was announced, and entered the apartment where Amelia was sitting at her music with such a degree of eagerness that he scarcely gave the servant time to name him ere he stood before her. His impatience, however, was not more evident than his disappointment, when on Amelia's rising to receive him, he perceived that she was not the lady he expected to see. The words he had begun to speak faltered on his tongue, and he stopped short in the middle of a fine speech, to the diversion of his cruel mistress, and the inexpressible confusion of his own feelings. The Duke was accompanied by Lord Summertown. He did not, therefore, dare to account for his embarrassment, and that nobleman attributed it solely to the foolishness inseparable from a boy's attachment. The Marquis of Petersfield soon entered the room and relieved him in some degree by turning the conversation upon general subjects. After some little discussion of the politics and news of the day, Lord Summertown asked the Marquis whether he had purchased the pictures at Christie's which he saw him bidding for.
"I have," replied Lord Petersfield, "and if your lordship will do me the favour to give your opinion of a Titian I have amongst the number, it will greatly oblige me."
"Certainly," answered Lord Summertown. "Let us look at it directly. The young people," added he, nodding significantly, "will excuse our leaving them together for a few minutes."
So saying, the two guardians left the room, and the Duke's embarrassment returned with increased violence. Miss Stanhope, who enjoyed her poor lover's confusion, determined to increase it.
"I little thought," said she, smiling archly, "when I received such polite attention from your Grace yesterday morning, after my unfortunate fall, that it was to the Duke of Albemarle I was indebted for assistance. But your Grace seems to have forgotten the whole circumstance, for you have not once inquired how I am after my fright."
The Duke was struck dumb at this speech. He mechanically put his hand to his eyes as if to ascertain whether they were really his own eyes, and Mrs. Stanhope burst into a fit of laughter that completely disconcerted him.
"It is time," said she, "to finish the joke. I perceive your Grace's distress, which is indeed an awkward one, and although I have been mischievous enough to enjoy it for a little while, I cannot find it in my heart to protract it any longer. I have entered most unwillingly into the deceit that is practiced upon you, and I feel myself unequal to the task of imposing any longer upon your credulity. I will, therefore, be candid, provided your grace will pledge your word and honor that you will not own I have done so until I give you leave." The Duke, whose curiosity was raised to the highest pitch by this preamble, and whose hopes began to revive at the same time, readily entered into the conditional promise, and Miss Stanhope proceeded with her hoax. "Amelia Stanhope," said she, "is a whimsical creature, for although I love her dearly, nobody is quicker in discovering her errors than I am. This giddy girl could not bear the idea of being introduced to her husband-elect as a commodity he was obliged to take whether he liked it or not. And having read in some novel, I suppose, of the metamorphoses of lovers to render themselves more amiable in the eyes of those they wished to please, she determined to get up a little drama, which was to be performed in honor of your grace's arrival. In this piece I have the principal part, for I am honored by personating Miss Stanhope, while she herself has assumed the simple guise which belongs to me, and in which you will see her perform, with admirable grace and naivete. In that disguise she expects to win your grace's heart, and if I have any skill in augury, her expectations are not ill-founded. Lord Summertown and the Marquis are both in the secret, and they are anticipating the pleasure of seeing your embarrassment when you find yourself entangled in an attachment so seemingly contrary to their wishes, and which the denouement of the piece is to dissipate in the prettiest manner imaginable. The moment I saw your grace enter the room this morning, I recollected your features, and knew you for the gentleman who assisted Miss Stanhope yesterday morning. The hoax, I knew, therefore, must fall to the ground, and this determined me to tell you of it first. And if you have half a grain of wit, you will turn the tables upon the authors of it, by appearing to believe things as they represent them, and acquiescing in their wishes as to the proposed alliance. This will secretly mortify them, whilst you can ensure Amelia's goodwill by clandestine testimonies of your admiration, and by private marriage with her under her borrowed character, you can put the most romantic finish to the whole affair. Rest assured of my assistance, provided you keep the secret, and when you have seen the pretended Fanny, you will be better able to tell how far you will like to proceed under my directions." It is impossible to describe the astonishment and delight that filled the Duke's mind as Amelia laid her pretended scheme before him. But although he wondered, he did not doubt. He readily, therefore, promised to act under the direction of his treacherous guide, who in return assured him that he would see the real Miss Stanhope that night, if he should meet them at the opera. The arrangement was but just made when the two lords returned, and the Duke soon after took his leave, saying as he quitted the room, "At the opera, then, madam, I shall hope to renew the pleasure I have enjoyed this morning." Amelia nodded assent, and the lover departed, accompanied by Lord Summertown, neither of them dreaming of the trick Miss Stanhope had been playing. She, however, was so diverted with the thoughts of it, and so delighted with the success which had crowned her first attempts, that she was in perfect ecstasies, and could scarcely perform the duties of her toilette for laughing at the frolic. End of chapter 12.